Students here, but also visitors that have come to today's event. So a very warm welcome from the School of Computer Science and from the University of Lincoln to everybody. Great to see so many people here today. Quick news flash for you, just for those of you interested. Our robot Linda apparently has just won the Eurobotics Robot Marathon. Great, Linda. Linda travelled a total of 45.1 kilometres, fully autonomously, in the new research lab at the Witham Wharf building. So a little bit of good news there, great achievement for everybody involved. And I can see various of those celebrating people there as well, so welcome to everybody. Okay, on to the main event today. So a very warm welcome, we're very pleased and delighted to welcome Richard Stallman to the University of Lincoln. Many of you will know Richard launched the Free Software Movement in 1983, and started the development of the GNU operating system in 1984. He will tell you a lot more about his work this evening. GNU, as you probably know, is free software. Everybody has the freedom to copy it, redistribute it, change it, edit it, whatever. And the GNU Linux system is basically the GNU system with Linux added. That's used on tens, hundreds of millions of computers around the world today. Richard's received many awards for his work over the years, and I'll just embarrass him by mentioning a couple of them. So he's received the ACM Grace Hopper Award, the MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Pioneer Award, the Takeda Award for Social and Economic Betterment, and several honorary degrees from universities around the world. We're very pleased and honoured that you come to see us today, Richard, and we look forward to your talk. So
thank
all
you,
welcome.
You might want to come over here closer, or you might want to retreat over there, depending on your personal character. I want to start by mentioning that I'm told that they're shipping lots of oil through this city on train cars. That's extremely dangerous. A few months ago, some such cars got loose and collided in a town in Canada and killed a lot of people by burning up the center of town. I suggest that you start demanding that they build a pipeline that goes around the city and doesn't go through it. If they're going to keep using it for more than a short period of time, they can certainly do that. It's also somewhat ironic to see the coal trains going through town while it still isn't flooded, helping to flood it, of course. I wonder how long they expect to continue using this university. So, I have some requests for you. First of all, if you take a photo of me, please do not put it in Facebook or Instagram. Facebook is a monstrous surveillance engine. And if you put the photo of someone in Facebook, you're giving Facebook one more piece of information to surveil that person with. We could dispute whether putting a photo of your friend in Facebook is decent treatment of a friend. But if we're not friends, that has no effect on me. However, putting photos of me in Facebook would hurt me. So please don't do that. Second, if you want to distribute a recording, audio, or video of this talk, please do it only in the ways that are friendly to free software. Now, I've recently found out that most GNU/Linux distros do have free software to play the MPEG formats. But you shouldn't put it in a place that distributes it with Flash, so not in YouTube. And don't distribute it in Windows Media Player or QuickTime. Also, make sure that the site where it's distributed allows downloading the file without running any non-free JavaScript code in its normal mode of operation. It's not good enough if there's a way people can fix things if they know what they're doing. The normal operation of the site is what you're inviting people to do, so you should make sure that that's fully ethical. And please put on the recording the Creative Commons No Derivatives license because this is a presentation of a point of view. Now, you'll probably have come across activities that say their goal is digital inclusion or closing the digital divide, activities that presume that it's good to use computers and good to use the internet. Is that true? That depends. Participation in a digital society can be good and it can be bad, depending on whether that digital society respects our freedom or not, whether it's a just digital society or an unjust one. If it's unjust, if it doesn't respect our freedom, then the right goal is digital extraction of us. So what are the threats to our freedom in the digital society? I'll discuss 10 of them. The first one being surveillance, appropriately, because digital technology has made possible a level of surveillance unprecedented in human life. Surveillance much worse than in the Soviet Union, much worse than what the Stasi did. There is surveillance by governments directly, and there's also surveillance by businesses. And they're not the same directly. After all, businesses can't just throw you in jail. But the data collected by the businesses is available to states, often with essentially no limits. Or if they have limits, as in the US, they come up with excuses to vitiate them. So we must think of the collection of data by businesses as a branch of state surveillance. As in effect, these businesses have been deputized by the state to watch us all. So it doesn't really make much difference whether it's a business or the state that's directly amassing the data. And these dossiers are enormous. Somebody got Facebook to send him all the data it had collected about him. He got thousands of pages. And somebody, the next point is, how do they do this surveillance? Sometimes they do surveillance through our own products, which increasingly are designed to spy on us, although not mine, because I don't use those products. I know better. You see, the spying is done by non-free software, software that the users have no control over. Spyware is one of the kinds of malicious functionalities found in many non-free programs. We know about spy functionalities in Microsoft Windows, in the software of the iThings, in Android, because Android comes with non-free software typically, in Flash Player, in Angry Birds, in the Amazon Swindle, where they can tell what page the user is reading at any time. I was told it has a key logger, but I don't have a reference for that. And in nearly all portable phones. So this is not an unusual piece of nastiness. It's quite common in proprietary software that it does spying. Meanwhile, if that means that we have a possible defense against spying on us through our own devices, if they're running free software, if they don't have proprietary software, then we can change the software so it doesn't spy on us. Now that's does not excuse anyone who makes it spy, but at least it gives us a way of protecting ourselves if they do. And that also tends to dissuade them. They're not as tempted to mistreat us if we can, if they know we can protect ourselves. But the surveillance is also done through systems that don't belong to us, systems that we communicate with but aren't ours. For instance, ISPs and phone companies. They accumulate dossiers of who we talk with. And in the case of portable phones, they also amass dossiers about where you have gone. Not me, though. I don't have one of those. So, for instance, the ISPs make logs of what sites a user talks with. The phone company records calls to and from the user and also records locations. Somebody in Germany asked his phone company to give him its list of his locations and the company refused, so he went to court and eventually won. The company gave him a list of 35,000 location points for a 6-month period. That's around 200 a day, enough to tell how a person lives. We can't stop that by controlling our own devices, because it's not our devices that are making the lists. Now, the surveillance functionality in portable phones is that they will send their GPS location on remote command, and in most of them, the user can't turn that off. However, well, that's something with a freedom-respecting phone, however, that the user could turn off. But the phone company can determine the phone's location without that help by triangulating as the same signal arrives at various towers. Then they can compute where the phone has to be. And each year they put in more cells, and thus they can get more accurate at determining the location of the phone. And there's no way to stop them, except perhaps carrying a parabolic antenna so that you can communicate solely with one distant tower. And they, maybe this, I don't know if this would actually be successful. I mean, maybe the signal would still be received at enough other towers that they could find out where the phone is. So the only way we can take action against this accumulation of data is politically. And they also have systems of surveillance, systems that are specifically for surveillance that have nothing to do with people except for surveilling them. The UK has a system of cameras by the side of the roads to watch all car travel. This has been in place for years. It makes a dossier about each car, and the information is compact enough that this information could be stored for years or decades. It can also track any car in real time. And the only way to fight against this sort of abuse of people's privacy is politically. Of course, they say that the purpose of this system is to catch terrorists, meaning dissidents. That's what governments do nowadays when they want to attack dissidents. They call them terrorists. It's been done here, it's been done in the US and all around the world. They think we'll still fall for this lie. Thus, surveillance is a threat to democracy. And the UK's car tracking system has already been used to attack democracy. Suspected protesters, suspected of being on the way to a protest, were arrested and held for without accusing them of any crime, but they were held long enough that they couldn't get to the protest. So this system threatens all of you. It threatens your rights. In fact, surveillance threatens democracy. Who will watch the watchman is a famous old question. Today we know the answer. Whistleblowers watch the watchman, but whistleblowers are threatened by surveillance. If it's impossible to speak privately with a journalist, you can't safely blow the whistle. And that's what it has got to. We now know, thanks to Edward Snowden, we know the level of general surveillance. And we know that it's so high that it's not safe to be a whistleblower. He had to flee. And he knew it. Well, if we can't have if we don't have whistleblowers, we can't find out what the government's doing, so we can't exercise control over it. That means it's not democracy. We know this thanks to Edward Snowden. Three cheers for Edward Snowden. Hip, hip, hooray! Hip, hip, hooray! Hip, hip, hooray! But now it's up to us to take action based on what he found out for us. We have to put an end to general surveillance that's so powerful that the state can reliably catch whistleblowers. To do this, it's not enough to put legal limits on the government's access to all these dossiers. Because any legal limits will say that access is allowed in order to catch a criminal. And they call the whistleblowers criminals, so they will be able to use these dossiers to catch whistleblowers. If we want democracy to be safe, we have to stop the collection, the accumulation of these dossiers. A legal limit together with strong protection for whistleblowers might do the job, as long as it's obeyed. But the minute that they repeal this law or ignore the law, the dossiers will still be there for them to catch the whistleblowers. But if we require that systems be designed not to surveil people, not to record who's doing what, then if someday they are inclined to change this, they might change it, they might ignore this, they might start the surveillance again, but they won't have the accumulated dossiers to check. AT&T is known to have kept a list of everybody's phone calls since 1987. And make it available to the state. AT&T should be required to erase that data. And everyone else too. They shouldn't be allowed to make their systems so that they keep such data. The next threat to freedom in digital society is censorship. Now, censorship is nothing new. The UK has extreme censorship, not as much as, say, China, but it's certainly not freedom of speech. People can be imprisoned in this country just for insulting someone. Now, that isn't freedom of speech at all. But 15 years ago, it looked like the internet would strike a blow against censorship. That it would be too hard to censor the internet, so states would give up. Today we know that any state can censor the internet if it is determined enough and willing to accept the price in money and hatred of the citizens. It can censor the internet. And this is done in many countries, not just in the obvious tyrannies such as China and Iran. We find internet filters imposed in countries such as Finland. Finland imposed these filters on all ISPs in 2007. Someone in Finland decided to do some experiments and determine which sites were blocked and publish this news. His site was blocked too by the same filters. He went to court. A few months ago, the Finnish Supreme Court decided in favor of blocking access to his site. His site is still running. It's in Finland. There's no law saying his site has to be shut down, only that people in Finland are not allowed to access it. You could probably access it. The data in it is old, he told me. But censorship of journalism about censorship is officially approved in Finland. A few years ago, the Turkish government announced that every internet subscriber would have to choose between censorship and more censorship, and even more censorship, and yet more censorship. Four different levels of censorship. But access to the real internet would no longer be permitted in Turkey. The UK has mandatory internet filtering. They started with sharing sites, that's censorship too, but now they're proceeding to political opinions. I wonder how long it'll take before they censor my site. It has political opinions in it too. There's also censorship of pornography, which will be mandatory in the UK for anyone who can't afford his own internet connection. You see, they're being very clever. They're saying clever, devious, and vicious. Because supposedly the censorship of pornography is optional. But it's on by default, it's going to be. So you have to turn it off if you don't want it. But the people who use internet cafes or universities or whatever, anything other than a personal connection, they won't be able to get it turned off. So they will have censorship imposed on them, censorship they can't avoid. This is tyranny. Freedom of speech means that we respect people's right to say things we disagree with. Of course, everyone respects the freedom to say things she agrees with, but if she really cares about freedom of speech, she respects people's right to say things she disagrees with. And the UK is starting down the path of not allowing people to say things the UK disagrees with. Australia does not have mandatory internet filters. Australia has a different kind of censorship, censorship of links. Electronic Frontier Australia was ordered to delete a link to a foreign political website on pain of being fined $11,000 a day. So it was effectively compelled to remove this link. And what was this website? Was it Islamist extremists? No, it was something almost as disgusting, probably Christian extremists. It was an anti-abortion website. And that's a despicable view, but people have the right to present that view, even in Australia. Now, there are many countries where material gets deleted if the state doesn't like it. In India, for instance, things can be deleted if they offend anybody's religion. Maybe my speeches would get deleted. Lots of things get deleted there. Things can also be deleted without a trial in the UK. I'm not sure about that in the UK. In France and Spain, and I believe now in Italy, I'm not sure the UK has that particular law. And the US will seize the domain name without a trial. So the site may keep operating, but people have to know its IP address in order to contact it. So censorship of the internet is spreading around the world. And it's something we have to reject completely. Because once you start saying it's okay to censor certain kinds of views or certain kinds of works because you think they're disgusting, well, there are lots of other things that some people find disgusting. I've seen works I found disgusting, like the movie Pulp Fiction. The violence in that disgusted me. I wish I hadn't gone to see it. I will not, I will choose not to see other things that are like that if I know. But we must not take our disgust for a certain work as a reason to censor it, because censorship is more disgusting than any of the works we might think of censoring. And if we don't keep that in mind, we'll end up under tyranny. The UK has an interesting censorship law which bans, quote, extreme pornography, unquote. One kind of extreme pornography is, quote, interference with a corpse, unquote. Now, since a corpse, when left to itself, does nothing except decay, it seems to me that putting the corpse in a refrigerator in a morgue is interference with the corpse. I don't understand what rationale this censorship law has. Are they afraid that corpses will be hurt, that they will suffer? What can you say? In any case, I hope that they don't censor depictions of nasal sex with plants, because I feel rather offended by that. Maybe they're afraid that the flower will suffer when my nose enters it. The next threat to our freedom in the digital society comes from data formats that restrict the user. For instance, because they're secret. This is known as digital handcuffs. Putting data in secret formats to restrict the user. Some applications save the data that the user enters in a secret format. They're proprietary programs, of course. With a free program, the format wouldn't really be secret because people could look at the source code and see what, figure out what the format was. Even if it wasn't clearly explained with some work, people could figure it out. However, that's much harder when the source code is secret, as it is in most proprietary programs. And in particular, it's secret in these applications. Typically, the developers do this when they see they have a commanding position in the market. And they think, if there were no competition permitted anymore, we would have to be on top forever. And they figure that blocking interoperability is one way of making sure there's no effective competition. So they block it with the secret format. Secret formats are also used for distributing data, such as published works. This is known as DRM, Digital Restrictions Management. And these are intentional malicious functionalities to stop users, typically, to control users' use of these works in ways that ordinary copyright law typically would not control them, or would not, things that are legal otherwise become blocked by this software. And then some countries have peculiar copyright laws saying, if a program blocks you from doing something, that makes it illegal. These laws were obtained by pressure from the copyright industry in the US and then in the European Union. It's one reason why Scottish independence might be desirable, because they could escape from the European Union that way, and also from the World Trade Organization. So these, we know about digital restrictions management functionalities in Windows, in macOS, in the iThings, in Flash Player, in the Amazon Swindle, in the PlayStation 3. Somebody figured out a way to jailbreak the PlayStation 3, and Sony sent the police after him, which is an egregious act, which is why we called for a boycott of Sony. There are also patented formats which also restrict the user. However, it may be that the free software community is escaping from this problem, but maybe that we're getting away with redistributing these anyway. The free software to handle these patented formats. And if they're losing their grip on the free software community, I guess that it's not as important an issue. There's also the special case of Flash. Now, Flash format is not secret and not patented, but Adobe changes it so much, often starting from zero. They'll call it a new version of Flash, and really it's a totally different format from the previous version of Flash. We have been unable to catch up. As a result, Flash in a website is a real practical problem, and you should complain to any website that uses Flash. So this is the reason why I put conditions on distributing copies of recordings of my own speeches. It's my opportunity to direct my own activity in a direction that doesn't add to the problem. I hope you'll all decide to exercise the same control whenever you make files to distribute, that you will choose formats and insist that others in your activities choose formats that don't mistreat users. The next threat to our freedom comes from non-free software, software that doesn't respect the freedom of whoever uses it. With software, there are just two possibilities. Either the users control the program, or the program controls the users. When the users control the program, that program respects the user's freedom. In fact, the users have control over it because it respects certain freedoms which are needed for the users to have control. So we call that free software. It's free in the sense of freedom. I don't mean zero price. I'm not talking about price at all, in fact. I don't mean gratis software. Sometimes we use the French or Spanish word, which in English we could pronounce as libre, to make it clear that we don't mean gratis. This is an issue of freedom, and that's what makes it ethically important. Price is just a practical detail. I wouldn't take non-free software if they paid me to take it. And they would, you know. So, for the users to have control of the program, they need the four essential freedoms. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program as you wish, for whatever purpose. Now, that includes business, because business is an activity we do in our lives. Freedom one is the freedom to study the source code of the program and change it so the program does your computing the way you wish. With these two freedoms, each user individually has control over the program. But that's not enough. First, because most users are not programmers. They don't know how to study and change source code. To them, it looks like complicated math, which they don't understand. But even for a programmer or for an organization with programmers, freedom one is not enough. Individual control by that organization of its software is not enough. Because any user will use thousands of programs, and no user except a state is in a position to directly exercise control over that many. So we need collective control, which means that any group of users are free to work together exercising control over a certain program to make it do what they decide they want it to do. And then also they've got to be free to offer copies of their version to others when they wish. This requires two additional essential freedoms. Freedom two is the freedom to redistribute exact copies when you wish, and freedom three is the freedom to distribute copies of your modified versions when you wish. These freedoms allow those who wish to cooperate to do so. And thus, the users have control over that program. With all four freedoms, the users have control over that program as much as they conceivably could under any arrangements. But if the users don't have all four of these freedoms, then they don't fully have control over the program, which means the program controls the users. And there's always some entity, the owner, that controls the program. So this owner, through the program, exercises power over its users. This non-free program is inevitably an instrument of unjust power, power for the owner over its users. Thus, every non-free program is an injustice. Non-free programs should not exist. Making them is doing injustice to other people. It's the non-free program in social terms is a trap. If it has attractive features, those are the bait. Their purpose is to attract people to become users of the program and thus fall under the power of the owner. So we should never give any appreciation to the developers of a non-free program that's just because it's attractive to use. That doesn't make it good. That just means it's a trap with very attractive bait. So you should never participate in the development of a non-free program. If you have no source of income and you're hungry, it's a lesser evil to steal food than to work on non-free software. Could you make me some more tea? So, nowadays, the owner of a non-free program is well aware of the power that gives him over the users. In fact, that may be the motive for developing the program, to get power over some users. Nowadays, widely used non-free software, well, the point is that the owner is aware of this power and thus feels a temptation to exercise it and thinks of making the program malicious in order to gain more at the expense of those users. So there's a constant temptation to make the non-free software malicious, which is perhaps why the widely used non-free programs have known malicious functionalities. I told you about surveillance spyware. I told you about digital restrictions management. There's a third kind of malicious functionality, backdoors, which means that the program receives commands from someone else telling it to do something to the user without asking permission, usually without even informing the user, And this is also a nasty thing to do. Back doors are known in Microsoft Windows, in the software of the iThings, in the Amazon Swindle, and in nearly all portable phones. The back door in Windows and the back door in portable phones are universal. This means that they give whatever entity controls the back door, whatever entity has the password to use it, the power to impose software changes remotely, any software changes. So any malicious functionality that's not in Windows today could be remotely imposed tomorrow. Windows is universal malware. And so is the software in portable phones. And so apparently now is Android. Today someone told me that his Android phone gave itself an upgrade or a downgrade, as a matter of opinion, without asking his permission. The universal backdoor in mobile phones has been used to convert them remotely into listening devices. When a phone is converted in this way, it listens all the time and transmits all the time. And you don't have to speak into the microphone for it to transmit what you're saying. It can listen to you from across the room. And if you think of getting some privacy by switching it off, that doesn't work. You see, they program it to pretend to switch off, but in fact keep running and keep listening and keep transmitting. The only way to stop it is to take out all the batteries. Sometimes you can take out one battery, but there's another that will enable it to keep listening and transmitting for a while. Some of these phones don't allow removing any of the batteries. I wonder why. So between the location tracking and the listening, I concluded that these phones are actually Stalin's dream. And that's why I don't have one. I'm not willing to choose. I choose not to. Well, when invited to carry a portable tracking and listening device, I say no thanks. I think it's my duty as a citizen to say no thanks. It's every citizen's duty to stick a finger in Big Brother's eye. Now, I can see that people find these devices quite convenient. I figured they'd probably be convenient for me, but there's some things we must not accept. However, recently I came to doubt whether they are such a convenience. They could be more of an addiction. At least that's what Sherry Turkle describes in the book Alone Together, how many kinds of communication technologies trap and addict people and leave them feeling compelled to spend lots of time using those devices, even though it's annoying for them. Maybe I'm actually better off not carrying a mobile phone. But I'm not going to make the argument, oh, they're such a horrible annoyance, I'm glad not to have one. Or the foolish argument, oh, they're such an annoyance, I wish I didn't have one. After all, when people say that, the obvious response is, well, then why don't you get rid of it, okay? I don't have one. I think it's right not to have one. I might accept such a thing if it were not full of malware. But you'll note that the examples I've told you about include the proprietary programs that are most used. Almost all users of any proprietary software use one of the programs I've mentioned. So malware is the usual case for proprietary software today. And for references for these cases, look at gnu.org/philosophy/proprietary.html. By contrast, the contributors to free software know they don't have power over the users, so they don't feel this kind of temptation. And as a result, we see that malicious functionalities in free software are rare. They're not impossible. We have a defense, which is that we have control over the software. It's not a perfect defense. No perfect defense is known. But it's much better than being defenseless, like the users of proprietary software. At least we can make malicious functionalities rare. I'll tell you about one example I know of. Ubuntu, which is a distribution of the GNU plus Linux operating system, spies on the user in a specific way that we know about. For more information, look at gnu.org/philosophy/ubuntu-spyware.html. Now, Ubuntu also contains some non-free software, which is another ethical flaw. But these two flaws are independent. I started the free software movement in 1983. I wanted to make it possible to use a computer and have freedom. It was impossible then. The computer won't do anything without an operating system installed, and all the operating systems for the modern computers of 1983 were proprietary. So if you bought a new computer, to make it function in any useful way, you had to have an operating system installed, inevitably proprietary, and there went your freedom. Since I was one man without much money and without much fame, I didn't see much chance of changing this through an ordinary political movement. And besides, I had no experience doing that kind of thing. I was an operating system developer. But I realized I could make this change occur just by doing work in my own field. All I had to do was write an operating system and release it as free software, which I would be able to do as the author legally, and then everybody would be free to use computers in freedom by running my system. So I was aware of the injustice of proprietary software, which most people didn't recognize as an injustice. I had the skills necessary to try to rescue people from this injustice, and it looked like nobody would do it if not me. So I had been elected by circumstances to do this job. It's as if you see someone drowning and you know how to swim and there's no one else around and it's not Bush, then you have a moral duty to save this person. Well, perhaps that statement is too strong. We could debate whether you'd have a moral duty to save Tony Blair or the people who protect, or Bush's torturers, or the people who protect Bush's torturers, such as Obama. But fortunately, I don't need to resolve those questions because I don't know how to swim. However, in the real occasion in my life, the work to be done was not swimming, it was developing lots of software. I decided to develop an operating system that would be entirely free software. Every piece of it would be free software. Because if one piece of it is non-free, that one piece tramples your freedom. In order for the whole system as a whole to respect your freedom, each piece of it must respect your freedom. Each piece of it must be free software under the user's control. So I then decided to recruit others to help. It didn't have to be written all by me. It just had to all respect users' freedom. I decided to make it a Unix-like system because Unix was a proprietary operating system with some nice technical characteristics, and it was popular. By making a Unix-like system, it would have the same advantages, and the Unix users would be able to switch to it easily. They would already know how to use my system. It would be used just like Unix. And then I gave it the name GNU as a joke. But not just randomly as a joke. It followed a convention, a custom in my community. The custom was, When you make a program similar to an existing program, one way to give credit is to give your program a name that's a recursive acronym, which says this program is not the other one. Like after I wrote Emacs, there was fine for fine is not Emacs, and sign for sign is not Emacs, and mince for mince is not complete Emacs. So, of course, when I made a Unix-like system, I called it GNU, which stands for GNU's not Unix. But in order to be a joke, of course, the name has to have another meaning. Why GNU and not SNU or UNU? They're not words. GNU is a word. It's the name of this animal that lives in Africa. It's also the most humor-charged word in the English language, because it's used in countless word plays, because according to the dictionary, the G is silent and it's pronounced new. So every time you want to write the word new, instead of spelling it N-E-W, you can spell it G-N-U and you've got a joke. Perhaps not a very good joke, but there are lots of them, and we've learned to associate this word with laughter. It's the ideal name for any software project. However, when it's the name of our system, please do not follow the dictionary. If you say, I'm using the new system, you'll get people confused. And it's not even true. We've been working on it for 30 years, minus a month, and we've been using it for 21 years. It's not new anymore, but it still is GNU. So please pronounce it GNU. However, there's another erroneous pronunciation you need to avoid, which sounds like Linux. Strange to say, lots of people, perhaps most people who talk about the system, call it by the wrong name. They call it Linux, but since they know that Linux was developed by Mr. Torvalds in 1991, they think the whole system was started by him in 1991, which is not true. We've been working on it. We had it mostly done by then. There was one missing essential component. That was the kernel. We started developing a kernel in 1990, but that one didn't turn out to be very usable. Well, that's too bad, but fortunately, in 1992, Mr. Torvalds, who had written a proprietary kernel called Linux, liberated it. He released it as free software. In fact, he chose, among the various free software licenses, the one that I had written for the GNU project, namely the GNU General Public License. So, once Linux became free software, people put Linux together with the almost complete GNU system, and they made a complete system, which was basically GNU. But it also contained Linux. So, if you want to give him a share of the credit, you could call it GNU plus Linux. Why not? But it's not right to deny us all the credit, and that's what you do if you call the system Linux. And that's not just not nice, it hurts the free software movement. It undermines our campaign for freedom, because people associate the name GNU with the free software movement's ideas, which I've just told you. But they associate the name Linux with the views of Mr. Torvalds, and they're different. He doesn't believe that users deserve freedom or control over their software, and he thinks it's okay to use non-free software, and he says so. Well, I'm against censorship. I respect his right to state these views I disagree with. But he doesn't have the right to cite our work as if it were his work, as a platform for people to follow his views and ignore ours. But that's what happens when people think this system is Linux. So please don't call it that. Please call it GNU plus Linux or GNU slash Linux. Please give us equal mention. Now, schools must teach exclusively free software. All educational activities must do this. It's an ethical obligation. It's part of what it means to educate people. And this applies to school, all schools of all levels, from nursery school to the university. And it's not just a matter of possibly saving money. Sure, that's nice when they can do it, but this is more than just making education a little better. This is about doing good education instead of bad education. Teaching proprietary software is bad education because it's implanting dependence. Using a non-free program is dependence on its owner. You're under the power of the owner. You need the owner to take care of you. The owner can shaft you if it doesn't. But the school has a social mission to educate good citizens of a strong, capable, independent, cooperating, and free society. In the computing field, that means teaching people to be capable users of free software and ready to participate in a free digital society. Teaching the use of a proprietary program, teaching dependence on a specific entity is contrary to this mission. Schools must never do it. Now, people will sometimes say, but aren't we all dependent? Well, we're all dependent on society around us. That's very different from being in a position of inescapable dependence on a particular entity. Why do you think some proprietary software developers offer gratis copies of their non-free software to schools? They want to use the schools to impose dependence on society. It's just like drug pushers. They say, here's a gratis dose. The first dose is gratis. Once you're dependent, then you have to pay. The school, of course, would not accept the gratis needle full of addictive drugs to inject into the students, even if it's gratis. And the school should not accept proprietary software to teach to the students, even if it's gratis. There's a deeper reason, though, for the sake of the education of the best programmers, the natural-born programmers. Typically, when they're 10 to 13 years old, they become fascinated with programming, and when they use a program, they want to know, how does it do this? But when they ask the teacher, how does it do this? If the program is proprietary, the teacher can only say, I'm sorry, it's a secret, we're not allowed to know. Thus, education is not allowed. Every program embodies knowledge. If it's proprietary, that knowledge is withheld from the students, which means the proprietary program is the enemy of the spirit of education and must not be tolerated in a school. But if the program is free, the teacher can explain as much as he knows and then say, and then offer each of these students a copy of the source code saying, read this and you'll understand everything. And those kids, being fascinated, will read it because they yearn to understand everything. And the teacher can tell them, if you come across any point you can't figure out by yourself, show it to me and we'll figure it out together. Which gives our natural-born programmer the chance to learn a crucial lesson. That code is not clear. That's an example of how not to write it. If even you, a natural-born programmer, have trouble figuring out, it's really unclear. So now you know, because these natural-born programmers need to develop into good programmers. They need to learn to write good, clear code. The way you learn that is by finding all the things that are hard to understand and learning you don't write them that way. How do you learn to write good, clear code? You do it by reading lots of code and writing lots of code. Well, only free software offers the opportunity to read the code of large programs that we really use. Then you've got to write lots of code, which means code for large programs. But that's hard, so you have to start small, which means writing small changes in large programs. writing small programs, that's not even starting to tackle the difficulties of large programs. You start that when you start writing changes for large programs. First, of course, small changes. And then you can move on to writing big changes, and eventually you can change a large program starting from zero, which is how you write a large program. Well, only free software gives you the chance to write changes of whatever size in the code of large programs we really use. Every school can offer natural born programmers the opportunity to master their talent, but only if it's a free software school. But there's an even deeper reason for moral education and citizenship, because schools must teach the spirit of goodwill, the habit of helping others. Therefore, every class must have this rule. Students, if you bring software to class, you may not keep it for yourself. You must share it with the rest of the class, including the source code, in case someone here wants to learn, because this class is a place where we share our knowledge. Therefore, it's not permitted to bring proprietary software to class except as an object for reverse engineering practice. The school, to set a good example, must follow its own rule. It must bring only free software to class except for reverse engineering practice, and share copies with everyone in the class. Why are so many people leaving already? Is there something, I hope it's not because of something I said.
The gaming site starts at 7.
I'm afraid they're going to be using non-free software there. They probably don't want to hear me say this, so that they'll get cognitive dissonance.
I see.
An addiction. Magic is an addiction. They cleverly designed it so people need to keep buying expensive new cards.
I agree. I've spent too much money on magic.
But this just goes to show that the tendency to design technology to be addictive spans many fields. You know, they do that in food, they do that in software, and they do that in games which don't involve computers. That's how they strike it rich. So it's very important to learn to recognize when something is addictive and say, I don't want to touch that. Anyway, to get back to the topic. If you have a relationship with a school, if you're a student, a teacher, an employee, an administrator, or a parent, it's your responsibility to pressure the school to move to free software. Not immediately. Migrating in a week would cause problems that could easily be avoided. It's not such a rush. After all, the issue is not going to go away. If they migrate in 5 years, at least they'll have done it. The point is to demand that they take steps big enough that they might migrate in some years and not in some centuries. If they don't really want to do it, but they want to pretend they're going to do it, they'll propose to take small steps, and you'll see it'll take centuries to get there with steps that small. Now, you can start by asking privately, but if that doesn't immediately bring about the change that's needed, then it's time to raise the issue publicly, because that's how you make other people aware of the issue, and that's how you find allies. Now, I mentioned reverse engineering. That's very important. Nowadays, many hardware products, like the peripherals in lots of computers, can't be used in the free world because the commands to run them are secret. So they sell you this hardware, and they won't tell you how to use it. Instead, they offer you some non-free software and say, run this, that'll use it. But you can't trust a non-free driver program or a non-free piece of firmware. Essentially, all mobile computers have this problem. There may be some model of tablet which doesn't. I don't know. So we need reverse engineering. Please, if you want to help the free software movement with technical work, do reverse engineering. If you want to make a big contribution, an important contribution, this is the area to do it in. I recommend that this university establish a class in reverse engineering. I recommend a year-long projects class for groups of students, like four or five. I figure in that much time they can make some progress. There's a tremendous commercial demand for reverse engineers. It's a sensible thing to teach, even if it were not needed so much by the free software community. In any case, I recommend focusing on peripherals, because that's the reverse engineering we need. Although occasionally there's a secret format it would be nice to figure out too. So, the next threats to our freedom come from websites, or more generally services in the internet, but most of them are websites. One is, they may send you non-free programs to run on your machine without even telling you. Web pages today often contain programs written in JavaScript. The fact that they're written in JavaScript isn't a crucial point, but that's what they're usually normally written in. That's the language that can be in a web page. But those programs can be free or non-free, just like any other program. Usually they're non-free. Usually that means these programs, non-free programs, install themselves in users' browsers and they run. And the users don't know it. They don't know, there's no sign given to the user, you're running a non-free program now. So if you want to avoid non-free software, what do? Well, I just keep JavaScript disabled all the time unless I look at a program and see that it's trivial, in which case I might decide to let it run. Except this, if it's trivial, the site's probably going to work without it anyway. But we developed something more convenient, a program called LibreJS. This is an add-on for Firefox that analyzes every JavaScript program that tries to install itself in your browser to see if it's either trivial or free. And in those cases, it's allowed to run. But if it's non-trivial and non-free, LibreJS blocks it and warns you on the screen, this page has non-free scripts, such and such, such and such. It does one other useful thing. It searches heuristically through the site looking for how to complain to the webmasters. If you've ever felt like complaining to webmasters, you've seen that it's a lot of trouble. But most of the trouble is in figuring out how. Well, LibreJS does that for you. So you can quickly and easily send your complaint. Please complain several times a day, if possible. It only takes a minute. You don't have to type in a lot of details. I'm sure they can find the details. Just say, I couldn't use your site because it tried to run a non-free JavaScript program, and that's unacceptable conduct. Please fix your site. Run LibreJS and visit your site and you'll see. Now this takes only a minute to type. You could complain 10 times a day in 10 minutes. You can spare that much time. How are we going to convince all those webmasters to fix this problem in so many sites? We've got to get them lots of complaints. So, if you know JavaScript, we are looking for people who volunteers to help us approach this problem in another way. We want to ask volunteers to look at a site that doesn't work and write changes saying, here's how you could make it work. And we want to send those changes to the webmasters, asking them please to do what's necessary. And thus, these volunteers would help the webmasters fix the problem. So, send me mail if you want to volunteer for this. Anyway, the next problem with websites is they collect lots of data. Now, sometimes they do it through surveillance, and the surveillance is broader than you would realize. For instance, we know that Facebook surveils its useds. I don't call them users, I call them useds. But Facebook surveils everyone else too. Everyone else using the World Wide Web. Because if you visit a page and you see a like button, Facebook knows that your computer visited that page. That's because the image of the like button comes from a Facebook server. And the Facebook server knows what IP address it sent that image to. And it also knows what page it was sent for because the browser tells it. That's part of the protocol. So the Facebook server knows it sent the image to this IP address for this page. Except if you're running our IceCat browser, then it doesn't, because our IceCat browser blocks these things. The purpose of IceCat, well, the first purpose was present only free extensions. But it has another purpose, which is protect your privacy, resist surveillance. Well, various websites are doing various kinds of surveillance. Many websites are connected with advertising networks. And if you visit the homepage, there's something in the homepage to tell an advertising network that you visited it. For instance, Google has Google Analytics. But that's blocked by Libre.js. It's implemented in JavaScript. And if you're running Libre.js, Google Analytics won't be told. And by the way, if you run a website and you'd like to get statistics about how people visit your site, well, I don't see anything wrong with that. But instead of telling some company about all the visitors to your site, you can do it by running the free program BeWeek, which determines the same statistics about how people are using your site, but respecting privacy and not telling anybody but you. But in addition, sites demand information from the user, like what's your name, what's your address, what's your this, that, and the other thing. And although that's not sneaky and secret, it's still harmful. And I almost never identify myself to a website. I almost never use the sites that would want me to identify myself. Except if it's an organization to which I would identify myself anyway, then I might do it. But I still won't do it from a computer I use for anything else, because I don't want that those computers to be associated with me. Now, there are services which invite you to store your data on those services. There's one situation in which that's not abusive towards you, and that is if you encrypt a whole bunch of data, not just one file at a time, but basically all the data you want to store there. You encrypt, you make that into something like a tarball, some kind of archive. You encrypt the whole thing, and then you send up this whole encrypted thing, and they can't find out anything from what you put there. And of course, to be secure, the encryption has to be done with free software, such as the GNU Privacy Guard. You shouldn't trust a non-free program, especially, well, for anything, but especially not for encryption experts say. Then they can't see what's in your data. Maybe that's safe. But if they can see the individual files, they're basically inviting you to be a sucker. The next threat to our freedom in the digital society comes from computerized voting. You can't trust computers in elections. Elections are a special case because as a voter, you can't tell whether your vote was counted correctly. You can't tell whether the real or virtual ballot box was stuffed. There's no entity involved that you can trust. Contrast this, for instance, with e-commerce. If you buy something from a company and you give the company your credit card number, well, you'll be able to tell if the company cheats you, because you won't get the product or it'll charge you too much and you'll see that. But you can't see if the election authority counts your vote wrong. As a result of this obvious fact, systems for secret ballots have been designed so that aside from the actual voter, every participant is being monitored by others all the time. And the purpose of this is to prevent rigging the election. Now, traditional voting systems are not that complicated. People of ordinary intelligence can understand how they're supposed to work and can understand what fraud is likely to look like. So you can train them to be poll watchers and send them to monitor to make sure nobody else is committing fraud. And that's what the integrity of the system depends on. But once a computer is involved, only an expert can even try to verify it's correct. And even that doesn't do much good. Suppose people check the program that's supposed to be in the voting machine last week, and they concluded that it's correct. Suppose you trust them. Can you trust the voting machine? Not necessarily. What if somebody else stuck in a modified program this morning intended to rig the election and is going to put back the correct program tonight after the election's over? All that will be left is a set of totals, which it's impossible to audit. So we must not trust computers for voting. There's another problem with them, that typically they generate electromagnetic waves that can be monitored from outside the building. So unless there are a lot of people voting at that place, it's possible to see how each person voted. You know, if you see, if only one person is inside and you watch the machine, you see what's on the screen of the machine, and you can see, oh, this person's voting that way. Well, you know who it is. It's the only person who's in there. And people have actually demonstrated this possibility, too. So you mustn't trust computers for voting. Now, computers for counting paper ballots, in principle, that might be okay as long as a recount is a real possibility. However, it appears that Bush's second election was stolen in the state of Ohio by paper ballot counting machines, which systematically gave results that were biased in favor of Bush. Some counties in Ohio used these machines and other counties didn't. In the counties that counted the votes by hand, the official results agreed with the exit polls. In the counties that used these machines, the official results were systematically in favor of Bush when compared with the exit polls. It looks like these machines somehow rigged the election for Bush, and that is what was conclusive. If not for that, he would have lost in Ohio and nationally. So you've got to make sure that a recount is a truly feasible possibility. And then maybe you can trust computers to make a count in case it's clear. But utterly foolish politicians want to go even further. They want voting by internet, which is basically voting for clowns. In fact, you might end up electing a clown who isn't officially running. because the security can be broken. Washington, D.C. held a dry run for internet voting, challenging people to break the security, and the election was won by a fictional robot. I don't think arranging for a clown to win would be much harder, even if it were a fictional clown. There's also the danger that... Also, if the computer you vote from is in a botnet, the botnet will decide how your vote is cast. It might tell you on the screen that you're voting for A, but transmit a vote for B. How would you know? There's also the danger that even if the programs are reliable and correct and secure, the whole system is bigger than the software. For instance, what if your boss says, I want you to vote from this computer while I watch? You can't take the risk that that will happen. So we must not allow computerized voting, and especially not internet voting. How much money does it cost to run an election anyway? Compare that with the overall budget of the state. Is it really worth taking a risk to save a little money on elections? Come on. I mean, in Switzerland, people vote on many proposed laws. They vote several times a year. They can afford it. It's not that expensive. Why take a risk? The next threat to our freedom in the digital society comes from the war on sharing. Decades-long campaign by the copyright industry to deny us the benefits of digital technology. What is the benefit of digital technology? It facilitates copying, manipulating, and transmitting information. Well, they don't want us to be able to do that. And they have been attacking us for decades. They started with propaganda, saying that if you share, you're a pirate. Well, that's calumny. They're saying, essentially, that helping other people is the moral equivalent of attacking ships. But morally, that's as wrong as you can get. Attacking ships is very bad, but sharing is good. When I say sharing, I mean something specific. I mean non-commercial redistribution of exact copies of published works. So I'm not talking about your personal data. That's not published, I presume. If you did publish it, I guess you want everyone to see it. But if you were a real dumb cluck and you gave it to Facebook, you want only bad people to see it. But if you really consider it private and you don't publish it, then it's not part of the issue I'm talking about now. So sharing is good. But they want us to think sharing is bad, so they call it dirty names like piracy. Well, if you repeat the enemy's propaganda terms, you're helping the enemy. So it's important to train yourself not to repeat them. When people ask me what I think of piracy, I say, attacking ships is very bad. We should send the Navy. But when they ask me what I think of movie piracy, I say, I like the first Pirates of the Caribbean. Well, you get the point. I look for a visible, funny way of rejecting the propaganda term. But if they had only used propaganda, I wouldn't call it a war. After all, they have the right to express their views, and I respect that right, even though I disagree with them. But they didn't stop there. Then they began perverting our technology to restrict us with digital restrictions management, the malicious functionalities that restrict the user's activities. And this is not acceptable. In fact, I think it ought to be illegal. But they did it, and of course, the governments were on their side, not ours. They have more to spend on election campaigns than we do. So, we began seeing in one medium after another these malicious functionalities. First, we saw them in DVDs. The DVD conspiracy required anyone that wanted to make DVD players to agree to keep the format a secret and design the DVD players to restrict the users according to the rules of the conspiracy. But people figured out the format and released a free program that could decrypt the video on a DVD. It became possible for the first time to buy a DVD and watch it with free software. It also became possible to copy the video on the DVD and share it. The movie companies didn't like that, so they purchased a law in the U.S. Congress. That's how laws are made in the U.S. Called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which imposed censorship on the free software that could play a DVD and any other program or thing that is mainly usable for breaking digital handcuffs. And sad to say, the European Union adopted a similar directive a few years later. So these are governments that have taken the side of those hostile industries against the public. Now, a lot of geeks say, oh, no matter what they do, we'll defeat them technically. Geeks love to look for a technical fix to every injustice. We can't count on that. There has never been a free program that can break the digital restrictions management on all Blu-ray discs. They have a scheme, I'm told, which they change every few months, where there's a certain kind of platform they provide on the Blu-ray disc, a program to run on it, and it checks the precise timing of things. It's very hard to write a replacement program, write a platform that will emulate their platform and give the program the same timing results and so on. No one, I'm told, has done it. The AACS encryption has been, there's a free program to decrypt that, but you have to know the key, and they have provisions for changing the key. So when people find out a key and it becomes known, they change the key. But it's even worse with streaming technology, because there, they can make people update the client at any time. If people ever figure out how to break the digital handcuffs of Netflix, probably Netflix already has five more different encryption methods ready to go, and the decryption method will remain effective for an hour after it gets published. We can't defeat them technically this way. They're also making hardware malicious. Modern PCs have an encryption system for the communication between the processor, the computer itself and the monitor. And in the latest Intel chips, this is inside the CPU. It's malicious hardware. So we've got to reject these products. But the next thing they did was they put it into music. At the turn of the century, there were corrupt discs. They looked like compact discs, but they weren't written right. They didn't follow the spec. So we called them corrupt discs. And their purpose was to be readable in an audio player and not in a computer. Sony came up with a clever way of doing this. Instead of writing the tracks in a squiggly way so that the computer couldn't read the data at all, they put a program on these discs. The idea was, if you put the disc into a computer, the program would run and it would take control of the system, breaking the security, and change the system such that it would restrict access to all the music on these discs. But it did more than that. It redefined a command to investigate those files so it wouldn't show that those files were present. And the command that would have deleted those files, well, it changed that too, so it wouldn't really delete them. If this sounds a bit like a virus, that's no coincidence. It's called a rootkit. It's the same kind of software that a virus would use to take control of the machine, and distributing this was a felony. Of course, Sony was never prosecuted. That's not the only felony they committed. This rootkit included free software that was copylefted. It was released under the GNU General Public License, which says that they're only allowed to use the code if the entire containing program is released, again, likewise, under the GNU General Public License. This is a measure to protect freedom for all users. Well, they didn't do this, and they didn't inform the users as required that they were getting software under the GNU GPL. This is commercial copyright infringement, and thanks to a law that Sony helped pay for in 1996, it's a felony in the US. But Sony was not prosecuted for this either. The government officials understand that their real mission is to help companies like that maintain their power over people. So they would never dream of prosecuting abuses like this. And we also saw DRM in books starting early in this century. Companies announced their ebook lines with ebook readers full of proprietary software implementing DRM with tremendous hype. One company had the idea it would launch its line of user restricting ebooks with a biography of me. So the publisher found an author and sent the author to me, asking for my cooperation. I said, only if this ebook is published without encryption and people are legally permitted to share it. The publisher said no, and I said no. Eventually, the author found another publisher who wanted to publish it on paper and was willing to publish it under a free license. So the book got written and published and was sold on paper, but also distributed online. You could download it and publish your own version. Eventually it went out of print. The Free Software Foundation now publishes a revised version, revised by me. So I call it my semi-autobiography. It has two points of view in contrast. I kept all the personal impressions of the original author, Sam Williams, and added my own responses to it. I kept all his quotes. So it does present his point of view in contrast to mine. I don't know if there's ever been another semi-autobiography. But there were lots of errors in the original edition, errors of just facts, which I fixed. The ebooks of the turn of the century flopped. And I told people, we haven't defeated them, we just drove them off. They'll try again, we have to get ready now. And they came back with products like the Amazon Swindle, which swindle readers out of the traditional freedoms of readers of books, like the freedom to acquire a book anonymously by paying cash. Impossible with the Swindle. But of course, there's much more spyware in the Swindle. If the user writes notes, Amazon can see the notes. The Amazon can see what page the user is writing at any time. I'm told it has a keylogger, so that all the user's input can be read by Amazon. Then there's the freedom to give the book to someone else after reading it. The freedom to lend it to various friends. The freedom to sell it to a used bookstore. Amazon abolishes those with digital handcuffs and with contracts saying that the user doesn't own the book. Amazon's respect for treatment of private property is like a communist country. You can't own anything. All your books belong to us. Then there's the freedom to keep the book as long as you wish. which Amazon abolishes with a backdoor. We know about this backdoor because in 2009, Amazon deleted thousands of copies of the book 1984, an Orwellian act, demonstrated in the most glaring possible way. So this showed that Amazon had a backdoor that could delete books. I've been told that Amazon can actually execute any command remotely. So that would make it a universal backdoor. But I don't have a reference for that. There was a lot of criticism for Amazon after this Orwellian act. So Amazon promised it would never do this again unless ordered to by the state. If you've read 1984, that's not very comforting. But don't worry, Amazon doesn't keep the promise anyway. About a year ago, there was another scandal. Amazon wiped out the entire book collection of some user, saying that that user was in the wrong country, and it wasn't allowed. And the punishment was summary erasure of her library. Well, this product requires people to be antisocial. If you get your books this way, it means you don't lend books to your friends anymore, which means that you're not their friend anymore. So make sure that you warn your friends before they fall into this trap. Tell them, I just want you to know that if you were to start using the Amazon swindle to read books, that would mean you couldn't lend them to your friends anymore, which means you're breaking off your friendships. Tell them this before they do it. Because once they buy the device, they might think that they would be wasting the money if they used it. If they didn't use it. And so they might go ahead and use it for that reason. Make sure to warn them. Warn your relatives not to give you a malicious device as a present. The Free Software Foundation just published a guide to the things you shouldn't get people as gifts. And make sure anyone likely to give you a gift sees this list. So, DRM is widespread, and as I've pointed out, streaming services are the worst. And of course, they also attack privacy by demanding to know who you are. So, then, they weren't satisfied yet, so they started to attack peer-to-peer sharing networks by abolishing the fundamental principle of justice, no punishment without a fair trial. They want to be able to punish people who are merely accused of sharing, and that's what they got with the Digital Economy Act. So right here is the beginning of punishment without trial because you're accused of treating other people well. But even that doesn't seem to be doing much to stop people from sharing. So in Japan, they have now imposed a punishment of 2 years in prison for downloading an unauthorized copy of something from the internet. And if that isn't enough, they'll start executing people. Because they are determined to crush resistance no matter what it takes. But it's no coincidence that they have imposed on us a series of unjust measures. Oh, I forgot to mention suing thousands of teenagers for hundreds of thousands of dollars for sharing. So, the measures they take are nasty and draconian because that's what it takes to achieve their aim. Their aim is evil. It is to stop people from sharing. Sharing is good, and with digital technology, sharing is easy. So the only thing that can make people not share is something nasty and draconian. So, of course, they will make things more and more nasty or draconian until we defeat them finally by legalizing sharing. We have to resist not just the individual methods that they use, but the evil goal behind them. We have to legalize sharing, which means non-commercial redistribution of exact copies of published works. But when they demand more power over us, they say it's for the authors. They don't mention that aside from, or the artists, sorry. They don't mention that aside from the artists that are stars, they abuse those artists constantly. They treat the stars very well, but the rest they exploit and abuse and don't give much money to. Well, if we appreciate art, we need to support artists somehow. But the existing system is designed more to support the companies than to support artists. We don't have to support artists by submitting to a repressive system. There are other ways to support artists. Now, I have nothing against artists selling copies or selling tickets to a performance. I don't see anything unethical about those practices, so I wouldn't propose any steps to make them change. But if we want to support artists more than that, I propose ways to do it that are compatible with legalizing sharing. Ways of supporting artists that will quickly persuade every artist to say, please share my work. So, here they are. One uses state funds. Some money from the state would be distributed to artists based on their popularity. Why based on popularity? Well, the existing system says it works that way. I'm just being conservative and saying let's keep that. But the money could either come out of the general budget or it could come from taxation of internet connectivity. It doesn't matter so much how the state would collect that particular money because it would be much less than we're paying now. So we'd be saving, so why should we complain about the details of how we pay this smaller amount of money? The crucial point is, how do you distribute it? The obvious way is measure the popularity of every artist and then distribute in proportion. But this gives bad results. The reason is it would give too much to the stars and not enough to everybody else who really needs more support. The thing is, stars can be much, much more popular than non-stars. It's easy for a star to be 1,000 times as popular as some capable, appreciated non-star. Well, with linear proportion, if A is 1,000 times as popular as B, A would get 1,000 times as much money as B, which means in order to support B enough that B doesn't need a day job, we've got to make A tremendously rich, which is effectively wasting our money. We don't have a social need to give A more money. So I propose we take the cube root of the popularity figure we measure for each artist. The cube root looks more or less like this. It keeps on rising, but it doesn't rise so fast, not compared with linear proportionality, which looks like this. So the cube root of 1,000 is 10. So if A is 1,000 times as popular as B, with the cube root, A would get 10 times as much money as B. Not 1,000 times, just 10 times. So the effect of using the cube root is to transfer most of the money from a few stars to a lot of medium popularity artists, the ones where more support would do a lot of good for the arts. This is a way we can support the arts efficiently with our money. And because of this improved efficiency, and also because of not supporting the companies that exploit those artists, we'll be able to support them much better with much less money. That's why we shouldn't care precisely how the state comes up with this money from us. We'll be saving so much and supporting the arts better. The other method that I propose is with voluntary payments. Suppose each player has a button you push to send a certain amount of money to the artists. Here, maybe 10 pence. Might be a good quantity. If the quantity would be chosen by each country to maximize what people send in any length of time. If the amount is too small, even if a lot of people send it, it won't add up to much. If the amount is too big, people might actually hesitate to send it, and the artist wouldn't get much. So there's got to be some optimal amount. So try to guess or figure out or compute what that'll be and make it send that much. And so when you listen, you could send the money or not. It's up to you. But if you send it, you'll feel good. The point is, it's a small enough amount of money that any of you could send it every day and you wouldn't miss the decrease in your finances. Of course, there are plenty of people in this country who couldn't dare ever send this money because with the cuts imposed by a cruel government, they can barely eat. So they will never send it. And that's okay. We don't need to squeeze money out of those poor people to support artists. There are plenty of non-poor people who'll be happy to support artists. Of course, the solution to the poverty is through UK Uncut. Tax the rich enough, and there'll be plenty of funds to support the poor. The problem that the government claims to be solving by denying those people the money to eat is an artificial problem created by its wish to let the rich go untaxed and businesses go untaxed. In any case, there are already artists supported by voluntary payments. There are some musicians that say on their websites, please give money if you like it. And if you give, say, $50, I'll give you this fancy CD. If you give $1,000, I'll have dinner with you. I mean, for each level of donation, there's something that they'll give you as a token of appreciation. They're asking for much larger payments, which, of course, far fewer people will give, but they get enough. There's also crowdfunding. And many artistic projects have been funded by crowdfunding. In this way, they get the money before they do the work. Downloaded and pay if you wish seems to work pretty well, too. A year ago, 13, I think, noted science fiction writers published the Humble eBook Bundle, a collection of eBooks, and they said, download it and pay if you wish. They got $1 million in a month, which I read was equivalent to being on the New York Times bestseller list. So voluntary payments work even when they're inconvenient. But why didn't you send 10 pence to some artist today if you liked some artistic work? It's not possible to send such a small amount. And besides, it would be trouble anyway. That union, maybe you'd think of sending somewhat more, but it's a hassle to do it. So I'm saying, let's get the obstacle that discourages people from giving 10 pence is not that they think I can't afford 10 pence, it's that it's not easy to do. So if we make it easy to do, we've got rid of the obstacle, and then the money will flow. And if we want more money to flow, we can have a kind, gentle advertising campaign, a public service message saying, have you sent 10 pence to an artist today? Why not? It's only 10 pence, you'll never miss it, and you'll feel so good after you send it. Go on, push the button. And people will do it, and they'll see how good it feels. So with these systems, we can support the arts much better than the existing system. We won't support the exploitative companies as well, and that's fine, that's what they deserve. After the horrible things that they've done to us, what they deserve is to lose everything. So what are the changes we should make to copyright law? We should legalize sharing. We should legalize remix, because the purpose of copyright is to encourage making new works, and to interpret it as an obstacle to making new works is just dumb. We should ban the kind of contracts that Amazon imposes, which say that you don't own the book and you don't have the usual rights that copyright law gives you. We should ban DRM. And And we should make copyright last a shorter period of time. A reasonable period, so that you actually see works go into the public domain that were written after you were born. Right now, it lasts until 70 years after the author's death, which means if it was written in your lifetime, you'll never see it in the public domain. Now, there's one last threat to our freedom, and that is the fact that whatever you do in the digital world, you don't have a right to do it. You could only do it as long as some companies decide to let you do it. If they don't cooperate, you're stuck. Now, if you've got something to say to the public, you can write it on a sign, and you can walk on the street. You have a right to do this. You don't need to convince a company to let you do this. But if you want to say this in the virtual world, you've got to get the cooperation of an ISP, a domain name registry, and a hosting service. And they can deny you this support arbitrarily. They can decide you violated the terms of service. It's purely up to them to judge this, and then they can cut you off. Now, if you want to collect money for the cause, you can walk around on the street asking people to give money. And anybody can give money because just about everybody will have money. Except nowadays, if he's the sort of fool that invites surveillance of all his payments by using credit cards, say. In any case, people can give you the money. They don't need the services of a company to do that. But if you want to accept payments in your website, then you can either use a payment company, well, they can cut you off arbitrarily, or you can accept Bitcoin, at least no one can cut that off, but it's still not anonymous. Which means we have much less in the way of rights in the digital world than we have in the physical world. The danger of this became visible when the United States government decided to kick WikiLeaks off the net. Not by legal action, not by prosecution, because WikiLeaks had not committed any crimes. There was nothing to prosecute for, but the US wasn't satisfied and was determined to do it by hook or by crook. So the US started intimidating the service providers that WikiLeaks depended on. First, WikiLeaks had rented an Amazon virtual server. Through intimidation, the US got Amazon to decide that WikiLeaks was violating the terms of service by distributing the information it was distributing. No court case was required to decide if this was so. Amazon just decided this is a violation, we're cutting you off. Then the US went after various domain names that were used by WikiLeaks and got rid of many of them, but not all. There were countries that wouldn't listen to the US. And then the US intimidated payment processors such as PayPal, Google, Visa, MasterCard, Bank of America. They all said they wouldn't transfer money to WikiLeaks. A company in Iceland said it would, since it was accepting payment from its customers by credit cards, it would accept also payments on behalf of WikiLeaks. So they cut off that company too. Well, this shows what it means if you don't have a right to do something, if you depend on companies. But that company that was collecting for WikiLeaks sued. It turns out that Iceland's had already applied some European Union law which said that since Visa and MasterCard have a large share of the market, they can arbitrarily cut off service to anyone. And the company won, and they were ordered to resume processing payments to that company. And so we're starting to see what it looks like when users have some rights, but we've got to make sure, but those rights are not strong enough. They depend on the fact that Visa and MasterCard have more than a certain fraction of the market. What if no company, no payment processor had enough of the market, but they were all intimidated? The U.S. government could do that. So we need to establish the principle that the services that people generally and organizations generally use in the internet can't be arbitrarily cut off. That if you've contracted for one of those services, you have a right to that service as long as you follow certain rules, but it's not up to the service provider to decide if you violated them. The service provider should have to go to court, just as if your landlord wanted to kick you out, but you've signed a lease. The landlord, if you don't pay the rent, the landlord can get you kicked out, but not just by himself. He'll have to go to court and prove you didn't pay the rent, and then he can get an order. So if you're paying the rent and not doing anything else the law says are grounds to evict you, the landlord can't evict you. And that's how it has to be in the internet. So at this point, it's time for, well, actually I should tell you how to get a bit more information. For more information about the versions of GNU/Linux that are free software, look at gnu.org/distros. For information about how to help GNU and the free software movement, look at gnu.org/help. For instance, you can join the Free Software Foundation. Go to fsf.org. We need more members. You can also join the Free Software Foundation of Europe at fsfe.org. They need more members too. So, at this point, here is an adorable GNU that needs a home. So I'm going to auction it for the benefit of the Free Software Foundation. If you buy it, I can sign the card for you. If you have a penguin at home, you need to get a GNU for your penguin. Because, as we all know, a penguin can't hardly function without a GNU. We can accept payment with a credit card if it can make purchases by phone from the US, or in cash. And since I'll be answering questions here for at least 20 minutes, you'll have time to go to a bank machine and get cash out of it and come back. When you're bidding, please wave your arm and shout the amount so I can hear you, because I have hearing problems. And you want me to hear how much you're bidding, I suppose. And please be silent when you're not bidding. I'm going to start with the usual price, which is £15. Do I get 15? Do I get 15 for this adorable GNU?
20.
I've got 20. Do I get 25? I've got 20. Do I get 25 for this adorable GNU? £25. I've got 25. Do I get 30? Do I get £30 for this adorable GNU that needs a home?
32.
I want to stick to multiples of 5 for the moment, sorry. To make it easy. Do I get 30? Do you want to bid 30? Okay, I've got 30. Do I get 35? I've got 30. Do I get £35 for this adorable GNU that needs a home? I've got 35. Do I get 40? I've got 35. Do I get £40 for this adorable GNU? £40 to the Free Software Foundation to defend freedom. I've got 40. Do I get 45? I've got 40. Do I get 45? £45 for this adorable GNU. £45 to the Free Software Foundation to defend freedom. Do I get 40? What?
45.
I've got 45. Do I get 50? I've got 45. Do I get 50? £50 for this adorable GNU. £50 to the FSF to defend freedom. last chance to bid 50 or more. Do I get 50 or more for this adorable canoe? Last chance. Gone for 45. Please come up. So, how do you wish to pay? Did anyone tell him where it's
going? Just the man that I know.
Okay, well, you should go now and get that. Meanwhile, now I'll answer questions. Because I'm hard of hearing, please speak loud and slowly so I can hear your question, and please get quickly to the point. Now, where are the stickers? Okay, outside there? Okay, there are also various little new items for sale, and that's another way to support us. And the stickers are all gratis. You could take as many stickers as you could put to good use. If you could use 10 stickers, take 10. Give some to your friends. That's also useful. So, now questions.
I have a couple of questions, if that's right. Earlier, you were talking about freedom of speech and how we don't have it properly in England, I know there's a saying in England, I'm not sure we have it in America, that's if you don't have something nice to say, don't say anything at all.
That's not freedom of speech.
But I don't, because there are groups in America who just spread hate, and I don't think that's an environment that anyone should have to deal with. I think...
If you don't have the freedom to condemn something, you don't have freedom of speech. There are things in life that deserve condemnation. There are people in life who do horrible things.
Yeah, you should have the right to say that. But then you should have the right to say you shouldn't be allowed to say these horrible things to people. Like,
oh, no. If it's a matter of saying horrible things, they've got to have the right to say them. Because if there's censorship, you will be censored.
Okay, so...
And saying isn't doing.
My example is the Westboro Baptist Church. And they are this group of people, and they picket people's funerals, and they make these people feel terrible.
I don't see why they shouldn't be allowed to picket a funeral.
Because that's like...
So what?
It's psychologically damaging.
No, don't exaggerate. If you're... You've got to be able to cope with people who don't agree with you and don't like what you're doing. The point is, there are people who are doing bad things, and you've got to be free to say so. But my idea of what's bad is different from your idea of what's bad, so we both got to be free to say what we think.
Okay, I think when you said that we don't have freedom of speech, I think we have the right to say things, but we shouldn't be allowed to use like racist speech and things like that. Things that
I don't agree with racism, but I am very scared of prohibiting racism, racist speech, and in the U.S. that's not prohibited. And that's for good reason. I belong to an organization, the American Civil Liberties Union, which defended the right of Nazis to hold a march. Now, they weren't killing anybody. They were just marching. I think I stand by that position of the organization. I dislike the political views of Nazis. After all, other Nazis would have killed me just because of who my ancestors are. But people have a right to express those political views. And if some political views are censored, soon others will be too.
So, I know there's like been cases where people will shout racist abuse at like, say, example, like a black man would take racial abuse from like a group of youths or something. And they should be punished.
I don't think so. I think they're wrong. But once you start punishing people for expressing what they think, just for saying it, then you're tyrannizing them.
Okay. I had a second question as well. Okay. It was just, you have the four rules of releasing software.
No, the four essential freedoms.
Okay, the third and fourth, it basically, does it completely stop companies or people from monetizing software?
I reject the word monetize unless we're talking about turning something into currency.
Okay.
Because the word has assumptions that I find vicious. Now, I respect your right to say it, but I'm not going to say things formulated in that manner. But it is possible to make money from doing things with free software. There are lots of companies around the world that do this. What it prohibits, well, what is incompatible with the free software status of a program is charging people for the right to use it. You can sell copies, though. I've sold copies of free software. The Free Software Foundation used to sell copies of free software. We don't get much income that way, so in 1990, we got plenty of income that way. Then the demand went down, I guess, as it became so convenient to download things over the internet. But there's nothing wrong with it, and there are some circumstances where people still do get money from that. But you're more likely to get money from some kind of service related to the free software, and there are companies that get their money from that.
Where do you draw the line between free speech and bullying or harassment?
Bullying or harassment has to involve a threat of something other than speech.
Psychological.
Making someone feel uncomfortable because of what you're saying is not something that is not the same as real harm.
Psychologists that would argue against you say that there is, because you think all the children have psychological issues because of how they were treated.
I don't believe that's the cause. I think that they've had a problem with a different cause from home. I think that those children were hurt somehow already.
But then they could have been hurt by their parents.
Yeah, they probably were.
But that's bullying again.
Well, but that's not a... But they were not hurt by something that any government plans to censor, were they? So, yes, that's an important issue. It's an important issue for public health, but censorship is not a solution to it. Censorship is dangerous, and I'm completely opposed to all those plans to censor the internet. There are other ways to help children avoid things like, was it Ask Me Anything? There's a site where children or teenagers go and they basically say, insult me. Well,
I think the examples we were talking about aren't over the internet. I disagree completely with David Cameron's idea of censorship of all the things he wants to censor. But I think it's just, there are times when, like, people have, when I was in middle school, I was fat, basically, and I was treated badly because of that. I had people call me fat, and that is damaging. It left me with issues, though. It's no longer true. I'm no longer fat, but I still sometimes look at myself and I say, no.
Well,
I'm not
I am fat. Okay? I don't think it's wrong to say to a person that you're fat.
I think it is.
We can't prohibit such things. You end up with a society that's totally regimented and repressed, which is exactly what the unjust laws of the UK involve. By the way, UK censorship extends to more than that. You can be imprisoned for having a copy of the wrong book in this country.
Same with America, though. If you have to copy the Anarchist Cookbook, go on Netflix, I'll watch it.
I don't think you can be imprisoned in the US for having a copy of that book. I can't hear you.
Columbine.
What about Columbine?
If you go to the school and have a copy of the book.
Then what?
I believe you can be indicted or something like that.
I don't think so. Maybe they could kick you out of school.
Can I ask, I can't remember which motto it was, but one said that the nature of society is, in order for society to function, you have to give away certain freedoms in order to certain protections. That is, for example, the way laws work, you have to give away your freedom to punch on your face so you have the protection of someone else doing that. This applies to people as well. I'm wondering whether or not you take this into consideration when applying to free technology and especially using stuff over the internet, is that yes, it isn't totally free, and maybe that should be the
case. No, those, the unjust attacks on our freedom in the digital society don't protect us. They give power to someone, power that's harmful and shouldn't exist. I make a distinction between freedom and power. Freedom is control over your own life. Power is when one has control over another's life. Now, punching someone in the face is a good example to illustrate what this means, because that's not freedom at all. Prohibiting punching someone in the face is not a denial of freedom, it's a denial of power. So what I'm saying is, we should have freedom, not power. Many issues become clear to decide once you make this distinction between freedom and power, because the right decision is for freedom and against power.
Eventually, if you then apply this to the free settlement movement, if you change someone's piece of software, say, to be trying to sell to people, and say, anyone having that, therefore you are taking power,
I don't think so.
No, I'm sorry,
I don't understand this.
To influence over their decision and their product.
No, it's not over their product. Products are not people and they don't have rights. Now, in a world where all software is free, obviously, person A is not making person B's program proprietary. So what person A has the freedom to do is change the program and distribute it. I use a practice called copyleft, where I put on the programs I developed, and I encourage other people to do the same, a license that puts a condition on the manner of redistribution, which says, when you redistribute, you must respect the next person's freedom. So you can't make this proprietary. You can change it if you want. You can distribute it with or without changes. But those copies you distribute must be free software in the same way. So the next person gets freedom just as you did. Now, that, I think, is a good practice because it prevents someone else from making the program proprietary and thus depriving someone else of the freedom that the author of the first version chose to recognize. And I recommend using copyleft, and that prevents the scenario that you just proposed.
Can I ask a question about the proprietary drivers and hardware? In GNU/Linux, there's a Lumber driver which talks to NVIDIA hardware, and NVIDIA also releases a non-free binary block.
Well, it can be. It's a non-free program that uses that hardware.
So,
I wouldn't use the word allow in describing what it does. It's too favorable.
I think NVIDIA's rationale for releasing non-free.
Does it matter what their rationale is?
Well, their excuse is to say that to open source that to free that code will enable competitors to see how their hardware.
Well, fine. So what? Basically, what they want is not so important that it could justify this nasty practice.
I have to disagree there. Sorry, can I just really relevant to something said before about pharmaceutical companies and things? But companies like NVIDIA, and you look at pharmaceutical companies, so GSK, for example, spend millions and millions and millions of pounds developing this hardware. If instantly generics can take that and redistribute it.
Well, actually, you're mistaken. The circuitry, we're not talking about the circuitry of how that hardware is built. We're only talking about the commands to use it. Now, I consider it such a bad abuse for a hardware to have that restriction that I won't use it at all. I wish they wouldn't develop it. So far from persuading me that I should give up freedom so that they will develop it, I'd rather stop them from developing it, because it's malicious in the sense that users can only use it at the cost of their freedom.
That could stifle progression.
Fine, progress is less important than our freedom.
Can I just say something else?
by that logic, you're arguing that for the purpose of freedom, it is okay to restrict, to say to these people, you shouldn't have the freedom to make this proprietary software. The entire argument.
Actually, no, I didn't. You're attacking something I didn't say. Yes, I'd be happy to live in a society, I hope that I will live in a society where there's no proprietary software. I don't advocate banning proprietary software for the same reason I don't advocate banning heroin. I think heroin is harmful. I would urge everyone not to use heroin or cocaine, but banning them proves to have to cause great harm. So I don't advocate banning proprietary software, although I consider it harmful and something I urge everyone to reject. Because the harm of banning things is sometimes very significant. So that's why I've proposed to ban specific malicious practices done with proprietary software, but not to ban proprietary software as such. I don't think people are entitled to the right to make proprietary software. I wouldn't see anything in principle wrong in that ban, but being aware of the harm that bans of widely followed practices can do, widely followed harmful practices can do, I don't advocate banning that one. So I've advocated banning certain specific malicious things that are done in connection with proprietary software, sometimes by the proprietary software, you know, malicious functionalities of restricting the user. I think that the seller of hardware should be required to tell the purchaser how to run the hardware and not just provide a proprietary program, which is the only way to do it. But I don't advocate banning proprietary software in general. Now, our society places too much emphasis on innovation as a goal, on so-called progress measured in a narrow way. Are these video accelerators from NVIDIA progress? Well, that depends on how you measure progress. I consider them so bad that I won't touch them, so I don't think they're progress.
But if they can allow us to do more computations,
they can't. They only. So what good is that if we lose our freedom?
If we can analyze mammograms of people with cancer a lot quicker, a lot faster, come up with cures, we could help save people's lives.
Well, you know, we could. I think that a powerful computer will probably have a good market even without being a video accelerator, and there are plenty of CPUs that companies are trying to make faster, and they do publish how to program them. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm sorry. It's something I never heard of. But I don't care, because freedom is more important than these things. Whatever supposed practical benefit they're giving us, it's freedom's more important. Yes, sometimes people sacrifice their lives for freedom. Have you never heard of that idea?
I know. What you're saying is, have your own freedom. You don't mind someone dying in the hospital. We can save them.
We could save them anyway, that's the other point. This is just one way to save them. I'm sure this job could be done without that particular kind of model of hardware. There are other ways we can make computers to do this job. They might cost somewhat more, but if we taxed businesses enough, there'd be plenty of money to do this. So there's a series of fallacies here. But this shows what I said, that our society places too much emphasis on a narrow, practical idea of progress, and that's used to suggest that we should surrender our freedom.
You say that the internet shouldn't be censored, and I do agree with you, but in the case of something like child pornography, do you not think that should be completely censored?
I mean, no, I don't.
So you're suggesting that, in a way, child pornography is acceptable because you don't think it should be restricted.
I don't think it should be restricted, and the arguments against it have several fallacies. First of all, they tend to refer to teenagers as children, and the so-called child pornography includes images of people who took photos of themselves lawfully having sex. because they're at their age, they're allowed to have sex, they're just not allowed to take a picture of it. And I read at one point that only 10% of the teenagers caught having taken photos of themselves having sex are likely to be prosecuted for it. But the next thing is, there's an assumption, which I think is fallacious, that anyone who wants to look at these photos is a pervert. Well, I once looked at an attractive woman as I was riding in a car, and she was attractive for her figure. I never saw her after that. It was the one moment I ever saw her. My father told me she was 12 years old. He knew her, I didn't. Well, am I a pervert? I mean, she looked like an attractive woman. But there are people who will say anyone who finds a 12-year-old attractive is a pervert. I think any normal man would have found that particular person attractive. And then there's the idea that all these images are images of some act of abuse, which is based on an assumption that no one under a certain age can possibly want to have sex, which is also false. And then there's the point that in the cases where somebody is really being abused, it's a crime anyway, and anyone commercially distributing it, if someone makes these images and has another, and person B distributes them, person B is participating commercially in the making of the images. And so that's grounds to prosecute person B, even without any general censorship. We don't call in general to prohibit images that show a crime. For instance, there is the Zapruder film, which showed a murder. Zapruder had nothing to do with committing the murder. If he had, he would have been prosecuted for that. But he just made a movie of a murder that he wasn't expecting to occur. And we don't say that it should be censored because it showed a horrible crime. Yes, it was a film of the assassination of President Kennedy. Zapruder just wanted to make a movie of Kennedy in passing by. He didn't know that someone was going to kill Kennedy. But it is a movie showing a real-life murder. So should it be prohibited because it shows a crime? That argument is clearly fallacious, but it's the one that gets applied to justify censorship.
This is a question over the internet. If you could elaborate upon the issue of GLP being dependent on commercial copyrights.
What?
If you could elaborate upon the issue of GLP being dependent
on... GLP is what?
GPL.
Oh, the GNU General Public License.
Sorry about that.
It depends on copyright. Mm-hmm. It's a mistake to say commercial copyright. It's the same copyright that any other copyright holder has, because there's only one copyright and it's established by law. So we have to work with what exists.
Can we just take one more question? So I suspect the longer we stay and talk, the more interesting it's going to become, the more questions will arise. And to be fair to Richard, who spoke to us,
I can keep answering for
you. I know you can. I hear you, sure. But let's take one more question and.
What's your opinion on the free distribution of software, or proprietary software, which is no longer being supported or sold by the rights holders?
Well, I think all software should be free, free in the sense of freedom. To use a program whose source code is secret is folly, and therefore some sort of law. I have to guess exactly what you're proposing. If the proposal is the source code would get released and it would really become free software, well, then it's great. Why not?
I'm talking about more the execution files.
Oh, you mean only binaries with no source code?
Yeah.
Well, that's no good. That's still proprietary software.
But the thing is, it'd be kind of like, should we say, orphan books. It'd be kind of hard to actually get the source code.
I don't advocate making anything open. I never do. I never did. You've probably heard the term open source. That's a term used by people who disagree with the free software movement's ideas. So, I mean, you can say that if that's what you believe in, but I won't. This is not a commercial question. This is a question of our rights, of our freedom. To use a program whose source code is not available means we don't control it. The users in general don't control it. And I don't consider that a solution to a problem. People who think that proprietary software is in general acceptable may have proposed that when a company stops distributing it, that they be allowed to redistribute the executable. That might satisfy them because they don't object to non-free software in general, but it isn't going to provide us with that program as freedom-respecting software, so I don't think it's a solution to the problem.
But it's still a way to, of course, preserve the actual programming.
It doesn't preserve it as something that that respects our freedom, so what good is it? None. It was no good when the company did support it, and I wouldn't use it, and I wouldn't use the redistributed executables any more than I would have used an executable the company gave me. They're both wrong.
But when you agree, for example, should we say video games, for example, that...
What?
The concept of video games, for example, is a software. Wouldn't you agree that...
Well, actually, the video game is a combination of software and art.
Hmm. Wouldn't you agree that the person who created the actual software should be reimbursed by...
No. I think that the software is unacceptable if it doesn't respect our freedom, and I wouldn't use it.
But what if it was a DRM free, but it requires...
If the software is non-free, I don't want it on my computer. DRM is a particular kind of malicious functionality found in many, but not all, non-free programs. Mm-hmm. Some programs, by the nature of what they do, do not raise the issue of possible DRM. There's nothing that you would naturally want to do that you should be able to do that it stops you from doing. The issue of DRM is applicable to certain kinds of programs and not very applicable to games, for instance. But the program might still be free or non-free. It is still free, either free or non-free. Any program is. So if it's non-free, I recommend that you not touch it, except for reverse engineering, perhaps, and I wouldn't have a copy.
So now there was an example in 1997 where a game called, I think it was called Abuse, was released for a commercial license, and like 12 months afterwards, the guys who made this release entire thing...
Once it becomes free software, I think it's ethical.
Well, would it still be ethical for them to, of course, get their investment back from the first...
Not that way. I suggest he use crowdfunding instead.
But
crowdfunding means he's doing acting ethically all the time.
But the thing is, back then, in 1997, there would have been no such thing as crowdfunding.
There wasn't, that's true, but there is now. So if we're looking at a question of what's right or wrong now, mm-hmm. let's not forget that there's crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. No. In cases like that, when the program was non-free, I wouldn't use it. And once it became free, then I would use it, if I wanted to.
Now what would happen if you say the program was originally free, then they decided to, of course, make it like a payment?
Proprietary? Not free program doesn't mean paying.
Or one-time fee payment, for example.
One-time fee payment for what exactly?
For eternal use of the program, for example.
Oh, but does that mean that you're not allowed to redistribute it?
Well...
Basically, I think it probably does. You see, there are two possibilities I can imagine. One is selling copies. I think selling copies is fine. You could sell copies of free software. Mm-hmm. You could sell copies of the free software I wrote. Mm-hmm. I could sell them too, and I did for a while. I think that's fine. But when you say to people, I'll sell you a copy, and by the way, you're not allowed to redistribute this, mm-hmm. for me, the by the way, you're not allowed to redistribute this is what matters. and the selling part doesn't actually matter.
But doesn't your isn't your software non-commercial, though?
No, what do you mean by non-commercial?
The licenses.
Oh, absolutely not. Freedom Zero is the freedom to use the program as you wish for any purpose, including business. If a program has a limit on its use, like you can't use it for business, you can't use it for this or that or whatever, it's not free software. Now, there are things that I think people shouldn't do. There are some things I think should be banned. But I don't think a software license should try to ban people from doing those things.
Are those for freedom enough to ensure that it's completely free?
Well, those freedoms are enough to give the users control over the program. For the users to have control doesn't guarantee nothing bad's ever going to happen. But it does mean that the users are not under the power of someone else. So free software doesn't and can't eliminate all bad things in the world, even all bad things connected with software in the world. But it protects us from one kind of unjust power.
We call it a hold there. I think I'd like to say that you've amused us, entertained us, informed us. It's been a fantastic evening. I'm sure everybody joined me saying thank you very much. We've had a fantastic time here. Thank you.
If you want to pay your dues in cash, you could join right here. Otherwise, you have to do it paying through the website.